Welcome to the Azure Security Podcast, where we discuss topics relating to security, privacy, reliability, and compliance on the Microsoft Cloud Platform.
Hey, everybody, welcome to episode 113. This week, it's myself, Michael, with Sarah and Mark. Gladys is away this week. And our guest this week is Craig Nelson, who's here to talk to us about the Microsoft Red Team. But before we get to our guest, let's take a little lap around the news. I'll kick things off. I've got just a couple of items. The first one is in public preview. We now have Azure Virtual Network Manager, high-scale private endpoints. There's this thing called Connected Groups that allows you to basically cluster together private endpoints information, just making it considerably easier to manage. If you've ever tried managing private endpoints one by one, it can be a little bit difficult. So this allows you to basically glom together 20,000 private endpoints into one connected group and manage them that way, which is absolutely magnificent. Next one is one of my favorite topics. You really need to make sure you guys got this all in place, because this is not just the only product that's coming down with this, but Entra Domain Services is switching over to TLS 1.2 and above, and completely deprecating 1.0 and 1.1 on August 31st this year. That is not a long way away. So you need to make sure that all your clients that are connecting to those services are enabled for TLS 1.2. To be frank, I think I've never come across one item where a customer had a problem, and it was some really old mobile platform with some funky Java or Kotlin app that had some really old library. The other mistake I've seen people make is when they actually hard code the TLS requirements into the client, so it can't connect to 1.2 or 1.3. So, you know, don't go doing that.
Okay, so me next. Couple of things. Well, one's a big one, but first up, we've got in Azure Container Registry public preview of continuous patching, which is lovely because it means we can patch things without having to rebuild containers. So go and have a look at that if you are using containers, which no doubt somebody is, or most people are in their environments nowadays. So my other bit of news is around MCP. Now, MCP, at the time of recording this, has absolutely exploded in the sort of, I'd say, last 6 weeks. If you haven't heard of it, MCP is the Model Context Protocol. It's open source and being driven by Anthropic. It allows agents and applications to discover and invoke tools in a standardized way. So you can think of it maybe a little bit like a USB standard. It's a client-server model. It's very new. The spec is changing regularly. And of course, there are some security risks around any new technology that we introduce. So I wrote a couple of blog posts on it. One is about general overview. Another one is about a particular type of attack that some researchers have found against MCP. It is actually just indirect prompt injection. So go and look at that. Also, we'll be definitely hearing more about MCP. And I understand it was actually mentioned at Blue Hat India yesterday. Also, on that same thread, we've also gone all in. We've announced that we're going to support in our products agent-to-agent protocol. Now, agent-to-agent protocol is similar to MCP. It's open source again. It's being driven by Google. And that is a standardized way that agents can talk between themselves rather than connect to resources. So that's the difference between the two. It's all very new, changing very quickly. So go and keep an eye on that. But certainly if your devs have started wanting to use MCP, that's something that you want to go read up on and educate yourself about ASAP.
Cool. So in my area, big thing is the MCRA, the Microsoft Cybersecurity Reference Architecture, has been released. That's our April 2025 edition is the current version. Replaces the December 23 edition. Mostly the same kind of format, no like real changes like the previous revisions where we went from kind of a single slide to a bunch of complex slides or to a full narrative kind of landing why end-to-end security is important, which were kind of previous things. In this case, it's sort of an enhancement of the current structure and format. And one of the big things that we did there was some of the work that that I and others have been doing with the Open Group to define, you know, roles and capabilities and all sorts of things in security that have been either partially defined or not defined well or just not defined at all. So some of that work made it into the MCRA. So you know, lots of goodness there. I've been doing a lot of continuing to do a lot of work in that space, and it's just really interesting when you lay out all the different roles and responsibilities from board members to CEOs to lawyers and finance people and you know, people in the security operations or SecOps or SOC and IT engineers. And when you bring all those things together and connect them and list them out and say, what is the thing you need to do? You know, kind of that old office space, what would you say you do here? It's just really interesting to pull all that together and kind of see how things actually work and should work. It's like seeing the human system as a system, like a technical system. And so it's been a lot of fun, a lot of challenges, and a lot of, well, what it really is the difference between a chief digital officer and a chief technology officer and a chief architect and a CIO. And so there's all sorts of interesting things that come up from that. But you know, we're publishing as much as we learn as we can. I'm going to include a few links in the show notes of the stuff that isn't quite in the standards yet, but you know, we're looking to get feedback on. But yeah, that's the big one is the MCRA. So we'll drop the link for that out there.
All right. So as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, our guest this week is Craig Nelson. Craig, welcome to the podcast. Would you like to take a moment and introduce yourself to our listeners?
All right. Thank you. I'm a longtime listener of this podcast, so I really appreciate the chance to be here with you today. I've been with Microsoft for about 18 years, and I started out as one of the first engineers focused on securing Microsoft's cloud. And you know, back then, the cloud was very small, and the problems were very different. And I've grown up with cloud and have had the privilege of being part of the evolution of both the technology and the threats that we see. So today I'm the VP of Microsoft's Red Team, and it's absolutely an awesome job because Microsoft takes red teaming incredibly seriously, and it's not just a checkbox. We work directly with engineers who shape security strategy, build secure architecture, and shape the investment decisions across the company. So as you can imagine, you know, Microsoft is, you know, constantly targeted by some of the world's most advanced threat actors and whom may actually be listening to this podcast. So I have to be very careful about what I share. But what I can say is that our red team is structured to view Microsoft in the same way that real attackers do. Because, you know, threat actors do not respect organizational boundaries, so neither do we. We look at Microsoft end to end. The red team is a centralized group of engineers who run breach operations across Microsoft infrastructure. That is the core of the team. And that's backed by a specialist who also perform deep technical research and exploitation so we can gain what we call high-value attack positions. We have an intelligence team that build a security graph so we can understand attack paths and risks and perform things like center of gravity analysis. And an engineering team that builds the tools and AI that we need to scale our work. But you know, in many ways, we operate like a nation-state level offensive team. But there is one major critical difference. Our mission is actually entirely defensive. We don't attack anything outside of Microsoft. We never touch customer data. And our goal is to proactively find and address vulnerabilities so we can help protect Microsoft and our customers.
So let's just start with probably the most fundamental of questions. Can you explain like the role of the Microsoft Red Team and just like what is red teaming, you know, in general?
First, let me frame how Microsoft's organization works so you can understand where Red Team and I sit. At Microsoft, we operate with a distributed security governance model. Our CISO sets the overall direction, and beneath him are deputy CISOs, each responsible for core security decisions across the different divisions of the company. Some of the deputy CISOs are leaders in our engineering orgs, such as Mark Rasinovich is the deputy CISO of Azure. Other deputy CISOs span critical areas, such as Ann Johnson being responsible for our customers. I bring them up because both Mark and Ann are very well known in security circles and in the podcast community. They're great examples to call out. Now, you know, Red Team reports to the CISO, and the work that the Red Team does spans the entire company. And the findings often influence multiple deputy CISOs. Now, you have to imagine you're one of those deputy CISOs, and your job is to understand the risks of the systems and how they behave against attackers in the real world. So you have that problem to worry about. Meanwhile, Microsoft is also in a very transformational phase where, you know, AI is changing the way people work and how systems are built. And that means there's a lot of code being written by AI. You know, products are incorporating AI very quickly. And the internal work of how we and the industry is going to use AI for productivity is just going so fast. So there are so many things happening at the moment, in this moment in technology, it can either be a blessing or a curse. And, you know, that's where red teaming comes in. You know, our mission is to help those security leaders, our deputy CISOs and CISOs, truly understand how the systems stand up under adversarial pressure. And I hope your listeners who are thinking about forming a red team can benefit, you know, from this and ensure that their red team and the folks doing this work are organizationally positioned in a way that the risks that are surfaced are appropriate to their security governance model and how decisions are made. Red teaming isn't just about breaking in. It's about emulating a range of threat actors, from low effort opportunistic attackers to highly resourced nation state level adversaries. And we look at how all the things come together in responding to that technology, people, process, when they're under real world stress. Red teaming is all about just challenging groupthink and status quo assumptions. And big organizations can quickly fall into patterns of thinking because, you know, they think that their checklists are complete. And, you know, red team exists to test those assumptions and expose that the gaps that matter the most.
So, Craig, what are the key objectives of red team exercise? Is it learning or I assume maybe there's probably a few things.
Yeah. So red teaming is about forcing the evolution of very complex systems. You can imagine how large the Microsoft estate is and all the complexity that's, you know, tied into building global services that fulfill so many workloads that our customers use. We want to force that evolution, and that makes us learn how these systems respond to real, you know, lawful good adversaries. That is the red team as one of the core objectives. So we want to understand how a motivated attacker would kind of move through the environment, how they would get that initial foothold, and then what the effectiveness of the defenses are. And then with that, when we see the red team having success, we know where to invest to better harden the system, you know, improve detections, as well as response, you know, efforts. That really boils down to mapping out real attack paths, right, across identity systems, network edges, and cloud boundaries. And we put a lot of time into making sure that we understand how detection and response works in the scenario where things fail. So, for example, in the industry, we talk about assume breach a lot. You have to assume that an attacker will always get in. The question is, how long can they stay in? We want to give our engineering teams a feedback loop as a adversary so that they can understand that. And then we are testing them to see if they can take the right steps to pursue the attackers, and then what they do to minimize their success. At the end of the day, you know, back to your learning point, this is all about shifting the mindset from hardening individual systems to protecting end-to-end breach paths. Thinking about how credentials, secrets, how information moves, where it's stored, what policies are applied, so you can really constrain what an attacker can do once they compromise the system.
Can you give us some? Can you describe a little bit more about how it, how red teaming enhances like the overall security posture, and like any kind of examples that you're able to share? Completely recognize there's limits on what you can share.
So that's a fantastic question. To really answer it, we need to acknowledge that humans need to have a threat materialize and be affected by it to truly understand it. So in security, it's easy to get stuck in hypothetical scenarios that really do nothing because you're overwhelmed. And today's complex systems, you know, there is an endless list of things that could go wrong, from denial of service attacks that can disrupt a company to a full-scale compromise with serious financial and reputational consequences. So if you're curious to how bad things can get, you know, ask ChatGPT about attacks that I remember from the past. There's one in 2014 from the Lazarus Group. Stuxnet is also infamous. Search for NotPetya. And you'll see that, you know, these weren't just one-off events. You know, they revealed a pattern, often what we will see in the future, and exposed techniques that start with hygiene that get quite sophisticated. And, you know, this forms the foundation of how modern cyber attacks work, and even cyber warfare. Practically, most organizations aren't worried about nation-state conflict, and that's good. You know, they're worried about ransomware, service outages, data leaks that can impact the trust of their customers, and that's where red teaming comes in. You know, it can help you figure out which of those risks actually matter to you in your environments, within your systems, as well with how the people respond. At its core, red teaming is about running a controlled test before a real attacker does, and it gives you that insight into how your defenses hold up under pressure, and just as importantly, how people respond. And it's what happens after a breach that matters the most. You're sitting down with those that were impacted and the engineers that may have created the problem, analyzing what broke down, and then figuring out how to improve. And that's what drives the improvements to security posture. So if you're listening and you haven't done red teaming yet, whether you're a big company or a small one, I strongly encourage you to learn more. You don't need to have a full-time red team to start, and even a small internal exercise can be hugely valuable. It's a great way to grow your security culture. You know, red teaming is designed to challenge assumptions, spark creativity, and it's actually a lot of fun. And it gives your security professionals and engineers a new lens on their work and helps the broader organization see security for what it really is, a very dynamic, evolving challenge and not just a checklist.
Just think about red teaming in general. I mean, are there any ethical considerations that come into play, or does the end justify the means? How does that all work out?
Yeah, the first thing I want to point out is, as I talk through this, you know, we are focused on protecting Microsoft. We don't red team customer tenants or systems. It is to protect customer data that's sitting on top of Microsoft's infrastructure. So, you know, ethics are non-negotiable. So every red team operation is governed by a very formal set of rules of engagement that cover scope, safety, impact, and, you know, who's going to be notified and when. And clearly, you don't want to disrupt any business and cross into data that you're not authorized to touch. That is really, really important. You have to be very intentional about how you conduct red teaming. For your listeners that are listening to this and they want to form a red team, or they want to have some kind of red team initiatives, even with folks that don't do red teaming as a full-time job, that's great. But it is really important that you craft what we call rules of engagement.
So Craig, you've already touched on this, but how do you define the rules of engagement for a red team operation?
Yeah, so the rules of engagement is kind of like the constitution of an op. We work with our legal teams, engineering teams, and leadership to define exactly what's in scope, what's out of bounds, and when we'll communicate before, during, and after the exercise. So just very clear bullet points so everyone is on the same page. Now, in terms of when we talk about what's in scope, right, it's really important that your red team has a very broad scope. So the rules of engagement are to set expectations that the scope is large, because the more you constrain, the less breach paths you're going to find. So, and then finally, in the rules of engagement, it covers safety mechanisms. So one important one is called deconflict. So if alerts go off and they're seen by the Security Operations Center, they have a very clear path that they can understand whether or not it's the red team or potentially a real threat actor. So we want to make sure that they understand that if an alert goes off, you don't have the idea that just attribute to red team and then perhaps no action is taken. In the best case, everyone in the organization responds to the red team as if it were a real threat actor, because that's where the bulk of learnings come from.
When you talk about like red teaming, it strikes me as a fairly broad set of skills. Can you kind of talk about like the skill set of red teaming and like just getting started and then what you kind of master and fine tune as you go?
You definitely need a deep mix of technical skills, adversarial creativity, and the ability to clearly communicate. And we have people that are experts in Windows internals, identity systems, protocols, network exploitation, cloud architecture. It's really where those skills come together is where you find the most creative novel breach paths through a system. But what makes someone great being on a red team is not just their technical depth. It's really their ability to think like an attacker, explore the edges, have that instinct of, you know, how things were designed to work, and then figure out how to kind of move around those edges and target conditions or dependencies that may have not been, you know, thought about in the system design. You know, one of this things I really appreciate is that intuition where folks understand how to chain together little subtle misconfigurations and then tie that to a breach path and then explain to an organization why it matters, why these things have to be fixed, and why they should invest time to get those misconfigurations or past architectural decisions changed to make the attackers have to navigate more terrain and increase the cost to breach, or just, of course, just make the breach infeasible.
You brought up an interesting point there when you said the people on the red team have to think like an attacker. It's interesting. I hear that term all the time. It's like, we make software so much better if more people just thought like an attacker. The problem is, unless you are one, you can't think like one. You really, really can't. However, all the people that I know on the red team are definitely world-class attackers. They don't just think like an attacker. They truly are attackers. And so they have that certain mentality. So what are the tools and techniques that are commonly used by the red team, or at least as much as you can talk about? And, you know, what's the role of AI in here, both from attack and defense?
So our toolkit spans open source, proprietary, and system native tools, whatever best enables the mission. In the reconnaissance phase, we use open source tools from GitHub, right? This is what real attackers use. This is what we use. And we use these tools to gather open source intelligence, enumerate networks, and map cloud attack surfaces. For command and control, we have frameworks like Sliver from Bishop Fox, again, available on GitHub, and custom infrastructure gives us the flexibility and stealth, you know, that we need to emulate real threat actors. And but just as often, I want to reinforce that it's important that your red team is just living off the land, using tools that are native and already present in the environment and operating system. So this is PowerShell, WMI, you know, certutil, and just classic Unix tools like SOCAT remain powerful, you know, decades later. I used SOCAT 25 years ago. I still use it today. But, you know, the landscape is shifting, and AI is rapidly becoming central to red teaming. So we use it to generate code, automate repetitive tasks, and speed up complex operations. You know, personally, I vibe code a lot of stuff. I build very fast functional scripts that stitch together, you know, APIs, analyze data, invoke tools on the fly. And it's, I look at it right now, that it's less about perfection. It's more about acceleration. But, you know, the next critical skill set, if I were advising someone getting into red teaming now, is really learning how to vibe code to connect AIs together and their data streams, you know, build lightweight orchestration, you know, across their environments, really centered on AI and AI platforms. You know, over time, this is what's going to evolve systems that, you know, take, you know, that take automated action, such as triaging logs, testing APIs, and remediating threats, you know, based upon learned patterns. Now, this is not going to replace humans. I look at it as going to supercharge red team engineers. You know, it's going to allow engineers that are doing red teaming to move faster, you know, test deeper, and simulate what real adversaries are doing themselves, because that data will be enhanced through threat intelligence. And, you know, real attackers are going to use the exact same approaches. So, you know, looking ahead, I think that the next obvious step is that all of the common tools that we use as red team will be invocable via AI. And they're going to be, you know, plug into multi-agent AI infrastructure. And, you know, these agents communicating over MCP, I know, you know, Sarah highlighted that earlier in the news, are going to, you know, coordinate what tasks are need to be done, such as source code analysis, and they will be invoked through a common orchestration AI platform that basically says, hey, here's these three tasks that I need to do, invoke these tasks across these tools, and that data will be brought back for that AI orchestrator to interpret. And then, you know, take the appropriate action. So across domains, and they'll do so at speed and scale. So I think there's going to be a big transformation in the products that we use today in the security world. So that's where we're going. Tools are going to become skills. AI is going to become the fabric, and, you know, red teams that are, you know, using this this automation are going to be able to stay on the leading edge to help ensure that defenders don't fall behind.
So, Craig, how do you measure the success of a red team engagement when you're all finished?
Yeah, so it's not just about how many systems are compromised. It's about what the organization learns and the changes and what changes as a result of the red team operations. We look at how quickly actions were detected, how quick and accurately the defenders responded, whether or not critical issues were prioritized, and whether or not there's lasting improvement over time. So a successful red team engagement must lead to real architectural, in many cases, cultural change about, you know, how systems are built and protected over the long run.
I just have to say, I love that answer, and thank you for saying that, because I see way too many people celebrating that we got in and we shamed you guys. And okay, so why are we paying you? You're supposed to help make us secure. Would you be able to share maybe like a real world example of an engagement that led to some of those improvements? Is that something that you'd be able to do?
Well, I can't share specifics from the internal operations, but I can give you some ideas of the type of things that we find and some of the patterns that we've been able to fix at scale. So I'll start with, you know, number one, overprivileged identities and applications. And what we, you know, tend to find a lot is either identities, either, you know, human or service principles, may have very broad assignments like owner, contributor, user access administrator. When you see stuff like that, that tends to mean that there's too much privilege being assigned just within the culture of the organization or within the specific applications. Applications are just granted far more permissions than they're needed, as well as OAuth applications are reviewed and monitored, and they can often retain access kind of long after their useful life. So this matters because once an attacker gains a foothold, that overprivilege, if they can get those credentials, can turn a small breach into something much, much larger as they get access to those identities and those credentials and laterally move. So to what to do there, the guidance is always goes back to the core of enforcing least privilege and then looking at enterprise applications more specifically and service principles for applications like application read-write-all and directory read-write-all and just very broadly scoped findings. So that's, you know, number one. That's the number one finding. After that, the second is inadequate credential and token isolation. So this is where you tend to find like shared credentials and DevOps pipelines and scripts and automation accounts and source code, and then like long-lived tokens, such as like a connection string or SAS tokens that can be used to access resources that an application may take as a dependency, such as a storage account. That matters a lot because those enable what I call, you know, silent privilege escalation. Some of these things are really hard to detect, but there's a lot of transitive risk that can be seen just simply from one system having access to another system via a credential that the attacker is using via this lateral movement techniques. Another area would be we just see flat network architecture and just overall weak network isolation. You know, one of the hardest things to get by from a red team perspective is isolation, primarily network isolation. You know, we tend to find that VNets that may span multiple zones of trust or hub and spoke models, where there is just a central point of trust that can pivot broadly within a network or a VNet, and then, you know, misconfigured network security groups and overly permissive access and data flows. This is a difficult thing to get a hold of. It was 20 years ago. It still is now, just because applications are designed to want to connect each other. And you really have to understand your network and your flows and make sure that if there's a problem, the default behavior isn't to open rules to allow applications to talk to each other, because that might not be corrected. And those are the type of things that red teamers find.
It kind of reminds me of the old fail-safe principle in engineering, that you don't want the dam to fail open where it's going to flood the town, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, to that point, weak application boundaries and like these assumptions, I think those boundaries are that dam. And you have to really understand your microservices and APIs that do assume trust across tiers, sometimes without authorization enforcement. That's a great analogy, that there are all these dams between the systems, but at the end of the day, all those dams have some point of failure, and you have to understand kind of what it is and what the consequence is if it's defeated.
Craig, so how do red teams adapt to emerging threats? We know things change all the time and different attack techniques. And obviously, I'm going to throw in, what about AI?
Yeah, red teams have to kind of live in the future a bit and understand what's coming down the pipe. Because AI is very powerful, defenders are clearly going to use it, and we see that today. And I just got back from RSA, where there's a lot of innovation in the space where the AI is being used to sort through large volumes of data, drive automation within the SOC, and drive consistency across the environment. So because it's going to get harder, at that point, the red team is going to have to use AI as well. And we know that real attackers are using and getting better with AI. Right now, some of them might be confined to crafting better spear phishing-y, you know, emails, but over time, it's going to look at things like automating recon, monitoring a target. So for example, you know, use generative AI to vibe code a script in Python to watch a particular endpoint over a long period of time to detect subtle changes in the attack surface, which can then raise an alert for the red team to move in. Certainly, analyzing source code at scale and kind of looking through source code with a new lens of where do vulnerabilities exist, not only in this semantic and the code flow, but also just how the human works, right? I look at source code that has like to-do comments or code that is just overly complex, sometimes being passed that for exploitation. I think the other dimension of AI for both a red team and a defender perspective is looking at code to understand what is being detected or where there are gaps in where telemetry is being generated. And then, you know, those are areas that you want to target. Certainly from a defender perspective, looking at code, and if there's a particular event, for example, for authentication, if that is not logged, that is something that should be fixed by the defenders, but also targeted by the red team. And in summary, we're doing a lot of the same things, just much faster, using AI to find the weak links and model attacker behavior more realistically to understand what threat actors are looking for. And then using that to drive quicker change within the environment, such as implementing more precision detection rules and understanding where there are vulnerabilities that previously haven't been easy to find.
One of the questions that we always like to ask is, what's a day in the life of a red teamer? I mean, is it always on the keyboard? Is it in conference rooms and meetings? What is it like to just kind of do this day over day?
Well, I'll start by saying that at this stage in my career, I'm not the one actively breaching the systems every day. I spend most of my time working within Microsoft's security governance structure and understanding what our CISOs and deputy CISOs need to make informed security decisions, as well as our engineering leaders. You know, they have to get the results that they need to be successful. But I'll share what I see every day from the engineers that work on my team, because that's where the action is, and it certainly makes a better podcast. Roughly half of their time is spent in deep technical work, hands-on keyboard, and that means building tools, writing scripts, reverse engineering, doing reconnaissance, exploiting misconfiguration, and navigating Microsoft's vast infrastructure as if they were real adversaries. So today, it's also about them using AI to investigate things such as understanding the details of an API attack surface without having to page through tons of websites and documentation. I am in awe every day of their technical depth, creative thinking, and the persistence that these engineers have to execute on a day-by-day basis so they can chain all the research and tooling together seamlessly to turn small weaknesses into meaningful breach paths. The other half of the job might surprise people. It's all about influence. It's focused on communication, which means writing down the findings, presenting to engineers, engaging with product teams, and building long-term relationships across the company. So a red teamer just can't, find a flaw. They have to explain it, persuade others to why it matters, and drive real change and verify that change is effective. So technical excellence is essential, but so is empathy, clarity, and collaboration. So to summarize, being a red teamer is part hacker, part diplomat, and part detective. So there's a video that I often refer people to. It's about a decade old now, and it's from a gentleman by the name of Rob Joyce, who at the time was the director at NSA. And he gave a talk at Usenix that's infamous in red team circles and available for YouTube if you want to check it out. So one of the things that he says in this video has stuck with me throughout my career, and that is, you know the technologies that you intend to use in your network. We know the technologies that are actually in use in your network. And today, that quote is even more relevant. And it's such a part of the day in the life of the red teamer. Because with the explosion of cloud services and APIs and open source libraries and microservices, organizations are assembling these super powerful systems with countless dependencies. And red teamers have to understand how those systems behave under pressure and not just how they're designed on paper. So a day in life is never routine. It's really chasing down real world edge cases and helping the organization learn from them to become more resilient.
So we always ask our guests something else at the end of the episodes, which is, if you wanted to leave our listeners with one final thought, what would it be?
I'd say, attackers are moving fast and AI is going to speed them up. But you always have to remember as a defender that you control the terrain that the attackers have to operate in. You can slow them down, you can expose them, you can shut them out, but only if you're designed for that and you understand how the attacker works so you can define and implement the right terrain for what you're trying to accomplish. You own the terrain.
All right, let's bring this episode to an end. Craig, thank you so much for joining us this week. I know you're a busy guy, so we really appreciate you taking the time to spend time with us. And to all our listeners out there, stay safe and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Azure Security Podcast. You can find show notes and other resources at our website, azsecuritypodcast.net. If you have any questions, please find us on Twitter at AzureSecPod. Background music is from ccmixter.com and licensed under the Creative Commons license.